Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why new data say the country's reservoirs are dealing with challenges.
And celebrating James Baldwin's 100th birthday as his writing feels more relevant than ever.
But first, the border and immigration remain at the center of both presidential campaigns just over a month from Election Day. And Vice President Kamala Harris took the issue head on late last week with a trip to the border here in Arizona. It was just the second time she's been there since she took office in 2021. She went to Douglas, Arizona, amid mounting political pressure to visit the border, walked along the border wall with Tucson Sector Border Patrol Chief John Modlin, and proposed even tighter restrictions on asylum than President Biden already has put in place. KJZZ's political editor, Ben Giles, was there with her, and he's in studio now to talk more about it. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
All right, so let's start with the political kind of buildup that led to this border visit, right? Like, immigration and the border are seen as political weaknesses for the Harris campaign, and there was a lot of pressure for her, it sounds like, to visit the border.
Well, pressure coming from Republicans specifically who frequently visit the border. We've had in the last 2 months, vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance out at the border. We've had former President Trump also at the same spot along the border wall just south of Sierra Vista in Cochise County. We see Republicans head to the border all the time. And one of their frequent critiques of Harris, not just as the Democratic presidential nominee, but as the current vice president of the United States, is that she had not visited the border enough. The last time she was at the border was in 2021 in Texas. Until she visited Douglas last week, that was the only time she'd visited the physical border during her nearly 4 years as vice president. So this was, in some ways, an effort to strike back at that critique that, she hasn't been there. She hasn't seen it. She hasn't witnessed for herself what Republicans call the chaos at the border.
Right, right. This comes at an interesting moment, too, but I want to ask you a little bit of a political question about all the campaigns that come to the border. As you mentioned, Republican candidates do this often. Is it becoming like a requirement? Like, you come to Arizona, you go walk along the border wall. Is it a photo op?
For a certain type of federal candidate, I think it's absolutely a photo op. It's a photo op for Republicans to, draw attention to an issue that they see as politically advantageous to themselves on the campaign trail. So yeah, it's a photo op when Donald Trump goes, and it was a photo op when Vice President Harris was there last week. I mean, she had not announced that she was actually going to walk along the border with Border Patrol agents. That was an unannounced part of her trip. And of course, it was an opportunity for the news to take pictures of her talking to Border Patrols, engaging with the border community. So it's a photo op either way, which made the criticisms of her visit ring a little hollow. We heard from Republicans who said, this is just a photo op. This is just a box to check on the campaign trail. And Right. It's like, well, yes, it's a box for everyone to check, though.
For everyone, yeah. Okay, I want to also talk about her choice to go to this specific place, to Douglas, Arizona. This isn't like a major border point of entry. It's not one of the giant crossings we have there. It's pretty small, kind of a sleepy town. Why did she go there?
I think for that reason, the fact that it was an opportunity to shine a spotlight on a border community that maybe is not always thought of or heard about in the national landscape. And I heard that from the community in Douglas. I spoke with the mayor of Douglas after the event, and he actually spoke on stage and helped introduce Vice President Harris. And he said it was great to have some attention paid to their, sleepy community, as you put it. It was great to have the spotlight on Douglas so they could talk about the issues that matter to them, which are not just, as Republicans might have you think, illegal border crossings in the area. It's the flow of commerce across the border. It's the community of Douglas that stretches over into Mexico. So it was a really interesting opportunity for, I think, that town to be seen in the national spotlight. It was also an opportunity for Harris, though, to tout some of the investments the Biden administration has made at the border, and administrations prior to that. It wasn't a coincidence that the stretch of border wall that she walked along, that was built during the Obama administration, not during the Trump administration, during the Obama administration. And the Douglas Port of Entry is also one of two ports in Arizona that the Infrastructure and Jobs Act is helping to refurbish and renovate. They're opening a new commercial-specific port of entry in Douglas that will help decrease wait times at the border. And that is something that the Biden administration championed, and that is something that Harris was able to boast about on this visit.
Okay. Let's spend the last minute or so here talking about the policy that she introduced. She has not said a whole lot about what she would do about the border and immigration until now. What did she have to say?
So she wants to create an extension of a Biden administration policy about asylum seekers and dealing with those who seek to enter the country seeking asylum, but outside a port of entry. The Biden administration has actually been sending those folks back to Mexico if they don't seek asylum at a port. And Harris wants to continue that. Harris also wants to, I believe she said she wants to prevent people from seeking asylum for another 5 years if they are caught crossing the border illegally beyond a port of entry. And she wants to restrict the number of daily apprehensions from 2,500 to 1,500 a week. And that will actually allow and has allowed the Biden administration to reject all asylum seekers, to essentially close the border when weekly apprehensions reach a certain level. Harris wants to make that more stringent. And as she said, she wants to encourage lawful entry into the country and discourage unlawful entry.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's political editor, Ben Giles, joining us this morning with more on Harris's visit to the border. Ben, thanks for going. Thanks for coming in to talk about it. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Reservoirs across the country are dealing with some of the same problems those in the West have been facing. According to a new study, there are longer periods of unusually low storage in many of the nation's reservoirs, and that storage has become less reliable. With me to explain what's happening is Kaylin Simeone, a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He worked on the study. And Kaylin, what to you are the key takeaways from this research?
Yes, absolutely. The key takeaways that we have are that this study highlights the changes that are occurring in reservoirs across the U.S. and the value of continued investigation, both at national scales like this study and at local and regional scales, on helping to improve and understand reservoir dynamics under changing conditions, especially hydroclimatic extremes. In this paper, we see longer periods of low storage in recent years in some regions, which suggests decreased reservoir reliability, or at least the possibility for that in a changing hydroclimate. And we also see maximum annual storage declining in many reservoirs across the country, suggesting that there are some changes that are impacting a wide number of reservoirs across the U.S.
Is there one reason why you're seeing lower storage in reservoirs across the country, or is it more regional or even local than that?
We think that there are likely a number of different causes. And again, we didn't investigate every possible cause, but we think that likely the two leading contributors to these changes are climate change and sedimentation, but other factors such as changing reservoir management could be at play as well. And for climate change, for example, bringing warm temperatures and changing precipitation regimes can impact reservoirs in a number of ways, including making things like snowpack less reliable or changing the timing of stream flow or snowmelt.
When you talk about sedimentation, what do you mean there?
Yeah, so sedimentation is the process where reservoirs accumulate incoming sediment from rivers, and that this causes storage losses as that sediment builds up behind a reservoir, replacing water that replacing space that used to be used by water. And so this process is called sedimentation, and it's something that most reservoirs plan for over their lifespan, but is something that sort of changes the usable water storage throughout the lifetime of a reservoir.
Okay. So in reading through some of the data, like, it doesn't seem like much of a surprise that reservoirs in the West are dealing with, you know, lower storage and lower levels. I'm wondering if it was surprising to you at all that reservoirs in other parts of the country are seemingly dealing with some of these same issues.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, we expected, especially places like the Southwest, which have had ongoing droughts for a lot of the last couple decades, to have sort of changes in their reservoir dynamics, something that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But other regions of the West, including sort of the Central Plains, Texas through the Dakotas, and the Pacific Northwest, we saw similar declines. However, in the northern Rocky Mountains, we actually saw declining low storage anomalies in comparison to the rest of the Western U.S. And we were really surprised, though, to see that in addition to those changes in low storages, we saw declines in maximum storages at many reservoirs across the country.
Meaning that fewer reservoirs are holding as much water as they can.
Yes. Specifically, we looked at trends in the maximum annual storage, so the highest level that each reservoir reaches in any given year.
So do you think that this all means that there needs to be a different storage system for water? Like, are reservoirs still the best way to be storing water?
I think this study doesn't look into policy solutions for addressing this and doesn't sort of investigate, you know, how reservoirs should be operated into the future. Only it mostly looks at how reservoirs have been operated in the past and looking at trends and trying to interpret what that might mean for the future. But I think it does highlight that the current climate conditions that we're experiencing and the conditions moving into the future are likely changing away from the conditions that many of these reservoirs were built and designed for, and that this may create additional challenges that water managers might need to respond to in order to keep the reservoirs operating in an optimal fashion.
Again, understanding that you didn't really look into policy changes here, I'm wondering if you have a sense of where this information, where this data fits into the overall discussion about water shortages, especially in the West, and how people use water and how much and in what capacity. Like, do you see this fitting into that conversation in a specific way?
Yes, I do think that this research highlights the importance of sort of a conversation at the national level of how reservoirs are changing, and that ideally we'd have research that's pairing sort of a national scale look at what's going on across many different reservoirs with more specific local or regional studies at specific reservoirs or specific basins in order to best understand how reservoirs are being impacted by climate change and what options there are to mitigate those challenges. And reservoirs specifically are something that people should care about because they're one of the main ways that water managers have to be able to impact the hydrologic cycle and where water is going and when it's going there. And millions of people have drinking water supplied from reservoirs or from the river systems managed by these reservoirs. And many more than that eat food that at some level is produced with water that is impacted by a reservoir. And so understanding reservoirs is really critical to understanding the ways that we can influence the hydrologic cycle and be able to best manage that for potential future challenges.
When you look at the data for some of the reservoirs in the West and the Southwest, did it kind of match what you had seen in other data, or, you know, some of the reports that we've heard about the status of a place like Lake Mead, for example? Like, did you find anything surprising there, or did it kind of confirm what you had already thought?
I think, yes, for certain reservoirs like Lake Mead and Lake Powell, it wasn't a surprise to see that low storage anomalies have increased through time. But I think we were surprised to see some of the outliers. Like, I personally was surprised to see that the reservoirs in the northern Rocky Mountains, sort of, again, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, didn't have those same declines, as well as was sort of surprised by some of the declines in some of the northern Central Plains, where in some recent studies on stream flow, have not seen those same declines or same increases in stream flow drought.
All right. That is Kaylin Simeone, a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Kaylin, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll take an audio tour of Chicano prints and graphics from the 80s and 90s from the ASU Art Museum's latest collection.
But first,
here's a story you might not have heard. Last week, sometime after midnight on Monday, there were gunshots fired into a Democratic Party campaign office in Tempe. But it was given little attention in the press. It's just the latest example of political violence in America and our tolerance for it. It should be a wake-up call, according to our next guest. E.J. Montini is a longtime columnist for the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning, Ed, Elvia.
Morning.
All right. So, Ed, I want to start with you here and your kind of outrage at this incident, or at least like what you think we should be outraged by, right? Tell us exactly what happened first. Like, this wasn't actually even the first time that shots were fired into that office. It's just that the first time it was like by a BB gun, right?
Yeah. I mean, the first time was reported, I guess, a reporter from the Republic found out that the week before the gunshots were fired into the office, a BB gun was fired into the office. And one of the things about that makes it, you know, kind of creepy and germane and recognize that this was a targeted event, not like a random shooting, is that it's a very nondescript office. There's not signage or anything on it. You have to know that that's who's working in that office if you're going to fire a weapon into that office. And because it happened late at night, because no one was physically injured, it was astonishing how quickly we just pass that on as if it's nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about your reaction to the lack of reaction to this, right?
Yeah. In some ways, the most shocking thing about something like this is how we don't find it shocking at all anymore on any level. I mean, it's like there's no one is really all that worked up about something like this because, I mean, when you think about it, the number of shootings that we have in the United States that get attention of one kind or another, even the most awful, disastrous ones where there are multiple casualties, they pass in and out of our attention span so quickly nowadays because we've literally just grown so accustomed to them and we take them for granted.
Yeah, you called it proof of the obscene level of tolerance we now have for gun violence. Elvia, let me ask you, like, do you think this is about more than just gun violence, but about our tolerance for and expectation of, almost, as Ed's pointing out there, of political violence?
You know what, and that's just it. You know, it begins with something like this, and then it can quickly escalate, and we already have seen it, and that's what we don't want to happen. I mean, Ed and I were talking about it before he wrote that column, and just the fact that it was absolutely nothing anywhere, and that, you know, that prompted a discussion that this is incredibly targeted, is with a purpose of intimidation. You know, thank goodness no one was there. You know, it was in the middle of the night, but clearly it sends a message, right, and to the workers, to the volunteers of campaign offices, and, you know, that they were targeting the Democratic Party campaign office here, but it could be any political office, right? And we should be denouncing that against anyone, against any political candidate, against any political party.
Mm. Yeah, that's another thing too. Elvia brings up a good point. If you noticed among the, even though the media didn't pay a whole hell of a lot of attention to this, other than the chairman of the Democratic Party in Arizona saying this is a horrible thing and this should never happen, I didn't hear any politician saying this is a horrible thing and it never should have happened. Mm. There was crickets. There was nothing.
I want to ask you, Ed, about that level of political violence and just the way it's changed. It seems to me that it's changed rather quickly, too, and a lot here in Arizona. Like we've seen poll workers threatened, election officials who, you know, have PTSD, people leaving office because they don't want to deal with it. We've seen, you know, several assassination attempts now of one of the major presidential candidates. Like, do you think like all of these things just sort of add up and we don't even process them in the same way anymore?
I think that we can become tolerant to anything. And I think that's a danger here. You know, like, we should not allow ourselves to become tolerant of this kind of behavior. You know, like, if you get accustomed to it, if you say, like, oh, well, in this country, that kind of stuff just happens regularly, then you're pretty much giving permission for that kind of stuff to happen regularly. And I think that it's a real danger for that to be the case. And starting with the January 6th stuff, things have ratcheted up in a way that's really unhealthy and potentially dangerous. And I hope we can stave that off before we have any other issues the next election. You know, it's not the kind of thing that we should allow to occur. And we certainly should not just passively accept it when it does occur.
That's the main problem, because it is done for intimidation. And you mentioned the election workers, right? I mean, yeah. we have seen it before. Who will want to work as an election worker or volunteer when they are facing threats like this, real ones? So that is a danger to democracy, right? And people don't like it when we mention something like that, because they think we're exaggerating. But, you know, when you don't have anyone working at the polling places, or, you know, at offices or counting ballots, and then we have to be looking over their shoulder when they're going home, I mean, that's a real danger to our democratic society.
I received an email from one of the volunteers in that very office after this came out, who was, you know, felt the same way in some ways about this happening. And, you know, I sensed in what she wrote, you know, just about how that impacted people. And it just can't be what we want. It's just that it's very dangerous to the process, for sure.
Do either of you think there's any going back? Like, are we able to return as a country, do you think, to a more normal level of tolerance for this kind of stuff, or a more normal level of political violence itself?
We have to be mindful, and we have to be calling out the political candidates who are, you know, inciting that kind of violence with a rhetoric and normalizing it. And that's what it worries me the most, you know, especially leading up to the November vote. We just can't become that numb. We have to call it out every time that we see it.
You have to reinforce, I think, the notion, particularly among politicians, that they have opponents but not enemies. If you have politicians who keep talking about the opposition as enemies, you're raising the threat level, you're raising the opportunity for this kind of violence to occur. You know, that's something that should be unacceptable, and it has become passé, you know, with a lot of people these days, the way they talk about people with whom they disagree philosophically and politically in a way that you should never be talking about people that way, because it just leads to the potential, particularly when you have a lot of unstable people who exist in this world, and you have such an easy availability of firearms, and things can escalate so quickly and so dangerously. It is incumbent upon people who want to be leaders to actually do that, to actually lead. And we're not seeing enough of that right now. We have some, but we don't have enough.
All right. We will leave it there. That is E.J. Montini, columnist with the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning. Ed, Elvia, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on. Thanks for talking this through. I really appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. This past August marked the 100th birthday of writer James Baldwin. For Dr. Neil Lester, the director of ASU's Project Humanities, Baldwin's voice in the American conversation has never felt more relevant, which is why he recently threw Baldwin a birthday party. The show's Sam Dingman was there.
So, because this is a birthday party, James Baldwin's birthday was actually early August, but we're going to treat it like the whole month. So we're going to sing Happy Birthday, and the Happy Birthday is not the Stevie Wonder version, because I never know when that stops.
On a warm Tuesday evening last month, ASU professor Dr. Neil Lester invited anyone who wanted to celebrate James Baldwin's 100th birthday at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe.
All right, one, two, three. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, James Baldwin. Happy birthday to you. Perfect.
The back of the store was packed, which Dr. Lester didn't take lightly.
And I do want to say this, though, because I know that there's something really big happening in Chicago right now. And the fact that you are here and maybe recording it at home means a lot.
1,700 miles away, at the United Center in Chicago, the Democratic Party was holding a roll call vote to celebrate the nomination of Kamala Harris, the first Black woman to become a major party presidential nominee. Meanwhile, 2 weeks earlier in Utah, the Republican state legislature had instituted a statewide ban on books by Margaret Atwood and Judy Blume.
Everybody, you know, James Baldwin is probably one of those authors that would be banned right now.
Two changing hands staffers set up microphones at the front of the crowd, and Lester explained how this party was going to work. Anyone there was welcome to take a turn behind the mic for 2 to 3 minutes to share either a favorite passage from Baldwin's writing or just offer their own personal experience of how Baldwin's work has impacted their lives.
Sort of like an open mic, but not so formal. We just want you to share. There's a way in which you can still experience James Baldwin without having read all of James Baldwin. And there's a certain way in which James Baldwin brings about a vibe. All you gotta do is hear a speech or read a passage, and it sort of stays with you.
It was possible, Lester admitted, that the evening might not feel as festive as a birthday party.
This feels a little like a eulogy, doesn't it? You know, people, but we can just share the words, because the words speak. Come on up.
Yeah, I usually don't need a mic, because I'm a loud brother. My 2 or 3 minute story.
The first speaker told the story of starting a Black men's book club and reading Baldwin's 1956 novel, Giovanni's Room.
I thought the main character was Black. When I prepared for the book club, I discovered he wasn't, because the story he wanted to tell wasn't a Black and white story, it was a gay story. And it was about being gay and the issues you had to deal with in the 1950s. The book hit me so hard and it meant so much to me because I have an openly gay son who lives his best life. He lives his best life as a gay Black man. And he's able to do that because people like Baldwin, when he wrote that book and began a process of people understanding that gay people are people too and have lives and experiences, ups and downs. And that book meant so much to me. He made my son's life better. And I always loved James Baldwin. I'll shut up now. Thank you.
A woman approached the mic holding a binder full of papers. She told the crowd that she felt inspired not only by Baldwin's writing, but by his decision to live and work as an expatriate in Paris.
I grew up in Arizona, in Phoenix, and it was not the best experience. So I left, just like Baldwin left America. I went to San Francisco, and I worked in the data network industry with all ex-military white men. And so this is a piece I wrote called Crawl Out of the Graveyard, and it's advice to my younger self. Just quit, you'll never be white, which means at B of A, you'll never be right. Quit this damn job, crawl up from under the dark, leave this place and never come back. They'll replace you with another token to check off the box Black. Get clear of these people, even though you need a job. Each time you go in there, those white men rob you of your peace of mind.
A young man spoke about his favorite part of The Fire Next Time, where Baldwin writes a letter to his 15-year-old nephew about what it's going to be like to grow up as a Black man.
He doesn't only just say what you're going to go through and it's going to look like this and it's going to be hard. He infuses it with love and hope and how his nephew can get through it. And then right after that, I read Go Tell It on the Mountain. I'd never seen myself so fully in a book before. I just saw my whole life. I saw the church I went to. I saw my mom. I saw my aunts. I saw my uncles. I saw just the language I grew up hearing. I could see that literature had a place for me, I guess, and inspired me to want to write about these kind of things. Just really inspires me.
Another woman took a deep breath before she spoke.
I didn't know I was going to cry. I don't know why I am, but to me, it's this giant love letter to life. And I'm so happy James Baldwin brought that passion of life. So I'm up here just to say thank you to James Baldwin.
Eventually, Dr. Lester returned to the podium to offer a story of his own.
I want to show you something that I received.
Lester reached into his bag and pulled out a letter. He received it not long after Disney announced plans to rebrand Splash Mountain, one of its theme park rides. The original design of Splash Mountain celebrated the racist tropes of the 1946 film Song of the South. But in 2020, Disney said they were planning to unveil a new version of the ride, inspired by the 2009 film The Princess and the Frog, which portrayed the titular princess as a black woman. When the news broke, an AP reporter reached out to Dr. Lester for a comment. Lester told them representation matters. And then he got the letter that he'd just pulled out of his bag.
The first line says, "There are no problematic racial depictions or stereotypes in Disney movies." It's just how it was in the past. Disney movies most certainly do not have anything to do with George Floyd and all the looters, killers, and vandals from the 2020 protests who should have been arrested and brought to justice, exclamation point. All stereotypes were and are meant to be funny. Grow a thick skin. Sticks and stones. That's the first paragraph.
The letter continues.
"There is no systemic racism in America, and there is no white privilege." And then there's this random thing at the end that says, "Everyone must stop transgender and question it. It is mental illness." That is a real letter. If you don't believe it, I'll pass it around. This is why we need Baldwin.
Lester reached into his bag again and pulled out a dog-eared collection of Baldwin's writing, with dozens of bookmarks sticking out of it. He flipped through it and read us one of his favorite passages.
"The story of the Negro in America is the story of America. It is not a pretty story." He says, "I still believe that we can do with this country something that has never been done before. To look around the United States today is enough to make prophets and angels weep." Now that could sound anti-American, but what that really, through my reading of Baldwin, is to encourage us to do better, to be better.
At the end of the event, I noticed a woman standing towards the back in a Kamala Harris t-shirt. I asked if she was sad she'd missed the DNC broadcast. "Not at all," she said. She'd set her DVR to record it. She couldn't wait to get home and watch. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
It was a dramatic weekend in the Middle East after an Israeli airstrike on Friday killed the leader of the militant group Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, can you bring us up to speed on what's happened?
Well, that's right. The conflict between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah has been growing rapidly over the past couple of weeks, ever since Hamas's incursion into Israel last October, which left 1,200 Israelis dead, and Israel responded with its attempt to destroy Hamas in Gaza, which in turn has left more than 40,000 Palestinians dead. There's been an ongoing conflict between the Iran-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon and Israel. Hezbollah had been firing rockets into northern Israel out of what it said was solidarity for Gaza, and most of which have been destroyed by Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. But tens of thousands of Israelis have been evacuated from the area, and recently Israel made one of its war goals the return of those people to their homes. Then a couple of weeks ago, there was an attack which has been widely attributed to Israel, where sabotaged communications pages used by Hezbollah exploded, killing dozens of people and injuring thousands more. Israel stepped up airstrikes on Lebanon, which are reported to have killed more than 1,000 people, and which Lebanon's prime minister says may have displaced 1 million citizens. And then, as you say, on Friday, an airstrike by Israel on Beirut killed the head of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and a number of other senior Hezbollah figures, as well as a senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard officer in Lebanon. Hezbollah has continued to fire some rockets towards Israel, and Israel has continued airstrikes on Beirut and southern Lebanon throughout the weekend. And then another escalation last night when Israel carried out what it called large-scale strikes on Yemen, targeting what it described as military targets of the Houthi terrorist regime.
So, Jonathan, what is likely to happen next in this conflict?
Well, there's no question that the assassination by Israel of Hassan Nasrallah is a major escalation and brings the region a step closer to a much wider and even more damaging conflict that has the potential to pull in both Iran and the United States. I think what happens next, though, depends on a number of factors. Firstly, how does Hezbollah respond? Its command structure has been dealt a serious blow, with more than a dozen top commanders assassinated recently. But its deputy leader, Naim Qassem, has been speaking today and acknowledged the death of its leader and other commanders was a big blow, but he denied its fighting capacity have been diminished. Hezbollah still has thousands of fighters, many of them battle-hardened from combat in Syria, and they're likely to want to exact revenge. So there is potential for Hezbollah to strike back with its substantial arsenal of missiles. And then there's the question of what Iran does next. Keep in mind, it has yet to respond to the assassination in July of the Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in a Tehran guest house. So it's likely that hardliners in Iran will be contemplating some sort of response. But Iran has also made clear that it doesn't want a major conflagration with Israel, though it could ask its proxies around the Middle East, such as the Houthis in Yemen, to step up their attacks. And that may be why Israel carried out airstrikes there last night. And then we also have to consider what Israel might do next. It didn't want to engage with talk of a three-week ceasefire in Lebanon proposed by the US, France, and allied nations late last week. And Israel's army has been warned again today that a ground invasion of southern Lebanon is very much on the cards. Israel's defense minister has spoken to troops on the Lebanon border about that today. So I'm afraid it's hard at the moment to predict exactly what's going to happen next, although there are certainly a number of scenarios that could be very messy indeed and involve significant ongoing loss of life.
Interesting. All right, Jonathan, let's go to Mexico now, where tomorrow that country will inaugurate its first ever female president when Claudia Sheinbaum is sworn into office. Remind us of her background.
Well, before running for election, Claudia Sheinbaum was the mayor of Mexico City. It's one of the most influential political positions in the country and seen as paving the way to the presidency. Ms. Sheinbaum's Jewish maternal grandparents immigrated to Mexico from Bulgaria, fleeing the Nazis, while her paternal grandparents came from Lithuania. She had an illustrious career as a scientist before moving into politics. And she spent years at a renowned research lab in California studying Mexican energy consumption patterns and became an expert on climate change. That experience earned her the position of Secretary of the Environment for Mexico City when the outgoing President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was mayor of the capital. He was effectively her mentor, and it was back in 2018 that she became the first female mayor of Mexico City, which is a post she held for 5 years until stepping down last year to run for president. That run was obviously successful, winning around 60% of the vote. And in her victory speech back in June, she promised continuity, saying she'd aim to build on what she described as advances made by Mr. López Obrador.
So what then are her priorities for the country as she assumes the presidency?
Well, she intends to continue further building on the welfare programs, which have made the outgoing president very popular. But the country is also grappling with a serious violence problem. During the election campaign, more than 20 local election candidates were killed in the run-up to that vote. Claudia Sheinbaum has said it's important to tackle what she says are the roots of the violence and has promised to invest in welfare programs to prevent poor young Mexicans from being recruited by criminal groups. Of course, one of the major issues facing any Mexican president is the country's relationship with its neighbor to the north, where you are in the United States. And those relations have at times been testy under her predecessor in office. Claudia Sheinbaum says she will ensure that there's a relation of friendship, mutual respect and equality. But in reference to the many Mexicans living and working in the U.S., she's promised to always defend the Mexicans who are on the other side of the border. And one other issue that I'll touch on that she's inherited from her predecessor is that of judicial reform. The Senate recently approved a controversial new policy in Mexico under which judges will be elected by popular vote. Its supporters say the change changes will make judges more accountable to the Mexican people. But critics have argued that it undermines the country's system of checks and balances and will strengthen the power of the governing Morena party. The bill triggered strikes and protests, with demonstrators even breaking into the building where the vote was taking place. The outgoing president has thrown his weight behind the reform after repeatedly clashing with Mexico's Supreme Court, which during his six-year term had blocked some of his proposed changes in the energy and security sector. So quite an in-tray for Claudia Sheinbaum to get across when she starts work tomorrow.
Yeah. All right. So, Jonathan, also tomorrow, another changing of the guard, this time with NATO, as the new Secretary General Mark Rutte takes over the military alliance. Remind us, please, how we got to this point.
Well, Mark Rutte's predecessor as NATO Secretary General is Jens Stoltenberg. He's served now for 10 years as the head of the organization and had his term extended four times. But NATO has been seeking a new leader over the past year or so. Mr. Rutte has previously been Prime Minister of the Netherlands for 14 years up until earlier this year. Prior to entering politics, he had a career in business management with Unilever. Mark Rutte's elevation to Secretary General seemed assured back in June when his only rival, Romanian President Klaus Iohannis, dropped out of the race. But there were stumbles along the way. Hungary, Romania, and Turkey had been holding out. Romania's opposition ended when their president withdrew his candidacy. Turkey said it would support Mr. Rutte's bid after the then Dutch Prime Minister travelled there in April to speak to the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And Hungary withdrew its opposition to Mark Rutte after he agreed that Budapest would not be obliged to commit military aid to Ukraine, which is something that Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has been opposed to. Now, one of the key issues that worked in Mark Rutte's favour in the nominating process is that he's built a strong rapport with the former US President Donald Trump, who, depending obviously on the outcome of November's election, could well return in January.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. When you think of historic art on the walls in museums, you probably think of art that is, well, old. But our next guest co-curated an exhibition at the ASU Art Museum made up of art from the 1980s and 90s and says it's also historic today. Brittany Corrales is a curator at the ASU Art Museum, and their new exhibition features a collection of Chicano prints and graphics from this time period that will be displayed in two parts throughout the year-long exhibition. Part two will feature the 2000s through about 2010. Every piece in the exhibition is a print made with a block or a screen to easily disseminate imagery. They're common in cultural social movements, like the one at hand here, the Chicano rights movement. The project is the result of a collaboration with ASU's Hispanic Research Center. And as Corrales told me while showing me around the exhibition recently, it was a winning collaboration from the start.
They gave us full access of their collection of about 1,000 works of art, and we were able to just comb through this really dynamic collection that is historic, that is modern, that is contemporary, and really start to build a narrative through stories that are told by these artists.
That's quite an undertaking, right? Like, you have 1,000 pieces of art that go back however long, and then how do you shape it into something that becomes, you know, something that is coalesced?
Yeah, it was rather difficult in this case because we really connected with a lot of the artworks. My co-curator and I, Alana Hernandez, we spent a lot of time sort of physically combing through their collection. We actually had gloves when we're, you know, going page by page looking at these prints and graphics. And, you know, ultimately we had to distill it to a handful of artworks that we felt most signified, personified certain movements and themes.
It is sort of roughly about the Chicano rights movement. We're looking at relatively recent art in art history here. This is the 80s and 90s, right?
Yes, it's funny. We now refer to the 80s and 90s as historic, which to me is very much, you know, that was my childhood. So, you know, some of the imagery really connected with me from this period of the 90s, from, you know, the particular color palettes that were used to the language and iconography, but it is historic now.
I love that. I feel the same way. And I'm looking around at just the, you know, the broad picture here of what's included from all of those, you know, 1,000 pieces you chose from. And it feels very 90s to me, very 80s. This feels like my childhood. Do you have a couple of pieces that exemplify this for you?
Sure, I'd love to walk you through some of the pieces in the exhibition. So this one here is by Yolanda Lopez. It's called Who's the Illegal Alien Pilgrim? And it's in black and white. You can see it's really graphically rendered. You can see that it's an image of an indigenous warrior who is pointing directly at the viewer. And it's modeled off of the Uncle Sam poster.
The I Want You. Yeah, I can see that. Oh, totally. Yeah.
And this was done directly in response to President Carter's 1978 immigration plan, which was really severe and overarching and really curtailed a lot of rights for immigrants. And the artist is really putting this question back to the viewer of who is allowed to make this determination of who is indigenous to a certain place.
It's really interesting. So something like this, no color here, but very emblematic of a couple of different times and places in American history that kind of speak a lot to us. Talk about this one. It looks like a picture of a mural, like on a wall, right? Like of graffiti almost.
Yes. Well, this is actually a print that's based off of a painting. So yes. So this is by Salvador Roberto Torres. You can see there is text as well as graphics. So it says Viva la Raza. And he is recreating his original painting in the form of a print. And what you see in the center here is an image of the eagle from the symbol of the United Farm Workers Movement.
Yeah, and speaking of that, the next piece here is, of course, of Cesar Chavez.
Yes, absolutely. So this piece is also a print. It's a serigraph, or also known as a screen print, by Esther Hernandez. And this is her homage to Cesar Chavez. It was done in 1993, the year that Cesar Chavez died. Famously, Chavez was a fighter for immigrant rights, particularly Chicano rights in the United Farm Workers Movement. And she's rendered this image in the likeness of a postage stamp. So you see it's in red, white, and blue, you know, the colors of the United States, just pointing to the fact that he was an iconic figure in the United States. And this was done 10 years before the U.S. Postal Service released an official version of this stamp.
Is this Frida Kahlo? Sort of in an incredibly complicated way?
Yes, this is an artist named Alfredo Arreguin who is portraying Frida Kahlo. So, you know, Frida Kahlo, we see her image everywhere today, right? You know, she's very recognizable as a figure. But she really wasn't until the 1970s when Chicano artists started portraying her likeness in their artworks. So here's an example of an artist in the 90s who is portraying Frida Kahlo in this really vibrant pink, black, and cyan blue composition and color palette surrounded by flora and fauna. This is called Frida's Messengers. And just really sort of deifying her in this way.
Talk a little bit about, because, you know, some of these are figures we recognize, right? Like we have Uncle Sam iconography, we have religious iconography, there's Frida Kahlo, there's Cesar Chavez. Like, talk about what was happening in the Chicano rights movement in the 80s and 90s that brought forth these figures and sort of, yeah, like made them saintly in a way.
That's a great question. That's one of the reasons why we decided to present this exhibition chronologically, because we wanted to emphasize the fact that in the 80s and 90s, there was sort of a resurgence of the political ideals and figures from the original Chicano rights movement in the 60s and 70s. So these artists were sort of looking to the past, looking to history, looking to the politics of that movement, and really popularizing them in art of the 80s and 90s.
This is like a look back at a look back almost.
It is exactly that.
So we have to talk about this last piece before we're done here, because this is the cover art of the whole exhibition and I recognize it here. It's of like a kitchen in, you know, somebody's house. The Virgin of Guadalupe is pictured on the wall. There's a taco and salsa on the table. Tell us about this.
This is a screen print by Larry Yanez. It's called Cocina Hiteca. It's from 1998. And we connected really immediately with this artwork as we were selecting work for the exhibition, because it's really portraying a very familiar scene of a home kitchen. And, you know, in the 90s, there was this term called rasguachismo. And it was really sort of this underdog aesthetic of the Chicano movement, really doing what you can with what you have. But it was also exclusionary of queer and feminist and women's perspectives. So another term was coined by Amelia Mesa Baines that was called domesticana or domesticanex. Looking at the domestic fear, looking at the feminine space, the everyday life and lived experience. So looking at this scene, it is a very familiar scene of a kitchen. You see a table setting with a salt shaker, a pepper shaker, some tacos on a plate on the center there, and this sort of old-fashioned kitchen, the Virgin of Guadalupe, a calendar with references to Aztec gods, and like you said, the really vibrant nature of this beautiful domestic scene.
So I want to ask you lastly, because this sounds like an exhaustive process putting this together. Have you heard from students walking through this or listened? You must love doing that, right? Like sitting in the gallery while people go through it and hear what they say to each other. I mean, I wonder like what the 80s and 90s look like, you know, to students today.
Yeah, it's funny. That's one of my favorite things to do, actually, is to just take a break and stroll through the galleries and listen to those conversations. But certainly, the students coming through are in 18, 19, 20 years old, and this is historic to them, you know? And it's almost like vintage is cool again, right? The 90s are back.
That is true.
So yes, I've certainly seen a lot of photography. A lot of these prints end up on Instagram, and we love to see it. We love to see it shared.
That's really cool. That's really cool. All right, Brittany Corrales, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Well, it might feel like July outside, but it's actually the last day of September today, which means it is officially time to start making plans to carve your pumpkins.
That's right, plans. If you put them out now, they will probably melt. But it's also time, by the way, to look back at all the songs we played on the show this month.
You can find the full playlist on Spotify. Just search for KJZZ's The Show. And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.